Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hey, everybody, it's Bruce, and thank you so much for pulling up a chair today on Table for Two.
Yeah, we can start. You can record from my entrance.
You know how that's fine. We do.
Okay, good.
We record, like, it's just there.
Gotta say, I've been really good today. Went to the gym. I had my green juice. I did my cold plunge. I did a long intermittent fast, all because we're having lunch today with Mr. Matt Bomer, who is one of the most beautiful men in Hollywood, both inside and out.
This is the dreamiest one I could hope for.
He's having an incredible moment in his career. He's been nominated for a Golden Globe. He's been nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award. He's currently, you can find him on Fellow Travelers on Paramount Plus and in the movie Maestro with Bradley Cooper.
I think I'm gonna do the kale salad and I'm gonna add some, I think I'll add some chicken to it. Thank you so much.
I like that.
So sit back, grab a salad, be healthy, and enjoy. I'm Bruce Bozzi, and this is my podcast, Table for Two.
So everybody, if you pulled up a chair today, I'm sitting with, as I said earlier, when you weren't in the room, one of the the most handsome man in Hollywood, one of the most talented men in Hollywood, a very dear friend of mine, Mr. Matt Bomer. Hey, welcome to Table for Two, buddy. I mean,
thank you for that introduction. I'm going to slip you a couple of 20s under the table for that. Thank you.
And you just said, too, and congratulations today, the Screen Actor Guild Award nomination.
Yeah.
It's a big deal.
Oh, my gosh. This one means a lot to me. It really does.
Because
it's your peers. You know this about me, and anyone who knows me knows this. I love actors.
Yes.
I really do. I love them all. I even said it on social media, but I love the salty ones too. You know, I love the complicated ones too. And it's nice to feel that from your community.
Right.
Yeah, it's a dream. I didn't feel like an actor until I was part of a union and I was able to get insurance and finally fix my tooth that had been aching for a year, you know, and get dental work done and all those things, you know. I mean, I felt like an actor, but I think there was legitimacy to it when I thought, oh, I can really make a living doing this.
And sustain your life.
Take care of myself.
Right, do all that stuff. And you say, you know, I've read and I know you, you know, when you hit New York, your family said, okay, kid, like, you're on your own. Do it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like,
no, they weren't paying that insurance
bill. $5,000 just to get, it was like, you're on your own.
I was on my own.
Which is really important.
I mean, I have to give it's a testament to my parents. I was fortunate enough that I got a little bit of financial assistance to go to college, and then my parents foot the rest of the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I'm eternally indebted to them for that, because I was fortunate to get out of college without student debt.
Right. That's a big deal.
It's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. But yeah, once I got to New York,
it's like, well, once you get to New York,
dad in tears.
You're like, all of a sudden, the non-student debt, you're just in debt because New York just sucks cash right out of you.
I worked which way. Two jobs to split a one-bedroom apartment to live in the city.
You did.
And now a very desirable place, place that's prohibitively expensive, but at the time was not.
Isn't that interesting? It's like impossible now, but it took two jobs plus.
Yeah.
You obviously having to go out on auditions.
Yeah.
But before, I just also want to say to everybody who's listening and to you specifically, congratulations on the Globe nomination.
Fellow Travelers
was amazing.
Thank you.
It, like I told you, I watched that twice. Second time even was just more powerful than the first. That hit me hard because, you know, not only being able to see the representation of two men who fell in love and seeing the sexualization of it, which is not often been depicted as, and to see the relationship. If you go back to the New York piece, when you were walking into a room and, you know, and you had, for lack of a better word, a secret, like, you know, you just knew something about yourself that you just had to sort of put aside going into a room to audition at a time when that would have that gotten away, you know? How did that feel versus how does it feel now when you, because you've become kind of, I hate to even say the word, like the embodiment of what it's like to be a leading man, to be able to just be you.
That's very nice of you to say. I don't know that I felt at the beginning of my career that I was even keeping a secret because there's no public narrative about you when you're first starting out.
Well, in your head, wait, would you like coffee?
I'd love a coffee for now.
Coffee,
I think I'll do some oat milk. Thank you so much. Cool haircut, by the way.
I mean, we're talking about a mullet verse. It's just longer.
Yours is much more refined.
Looks
a lot better than mine.
Thank you. I don't know. Carrie Mulligan, who I adore, she did a haircut for this guy on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. I don't know if you saw it or not, but it looked very similar to what you have going on. And I actually loved it. I thought she did kind of brilliant work, I have to say.
So. You are the king of mullets.
It's a good label to have.
Yeah.
Tell me your name again.
Eric.
I'm Matt. Sorry, Matt. It's very nice to meet you, Eric.
Eric's mullet gets a lot of attention during this show. Just so you
know. It's a running bit.
Flipped over.
Yeah,
she loved it so much.
It's good.
Okay, so you say that, but you knew.
So yeah, you know, I didn't really feel like I of course, on some level, you feel like you're holding a secret. But there wasn't anyone who cared to know anything about me. I was just a guy trying to get a job. And in many ways, I still feel the same, you know?
Really?
I just think, you know, ultimately you're just an actor trying to get a job. And if you're fortunate enough to have a little bit of autonomy or choice, then, and the right project comes along that you can give voice to, that's great. You know, you said, and what does it feel like now? I think one of the big differences now is that back then, I don't think I would have even gotten to audition for a role like Fellow Travelers. I think it probably would have just gone to a straight actor.
Right.
I think, and you know, they would have done a great job with it.
Right.
But in terms of opportunity, I don't know that I would have even had a chance to be at the table. Now, so a lot of that's a testament to Ron Nicewander, Robbie Rogers, and wanting to bring that sort of authenticity in the storytelling to this piece.
Do you say that in context to you wouldn't have been at the table if you were openly gay versus not, or at a point of just, you know, being famous?
So this is kind of a nuanced answer because it's not even about famous. Or I just think that role wouldn't have been open to auditions. And if it were offered to somebody, it probably at that time would have been offered to a straight actor.
Yeah. Right. You know, because, you know, the whole...
It could have easily been today, you know.
You think?
I do, yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess because, I mean, I think like if you just rewind not so long ago when like something, and we've referenced Milk with Sean Penn, or we referenced Brokeback with Heath and with Jake, and you have like actors that are not gay that are playing these parts, and you've experienced this as any gay actor has, like, oh, when you get the part, or like, oh, he's gay, okay, you know what, I don't think we're gonna go there. If
or we'll do one of the characters gay, but the other guy has to be straight, or whatever. Look, these are all versions that work.
Right.
All those actors gave their hearts and souls and minds to these stories.
Completely.
Look at the incredible LGBTQ stories that have or projects that have been produced and made and done so with love and respect by so many people across the spectrum, whether yes. it's people drinking people's bathwater or pushing the civil rights movement forward. Yep. It's been wherever you fall on that spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been kind of an amazing year. We're told by all different kinds of people. And I think that's great. I think that, and actors are actors. We should play roles.
Well, that's what I think.
And so I what I think is nice is that there are opportunities now. Right. I think opportunity is the real word that, right. you know, it's at least you get a shot to be in the room and audition or fight for the role.
Yeah. I mean, I think getting that role and, well, I mean, as a person who, you know, grew up at a time when, you know, there was no representation or no, you know, you the only people you saw on television that kind of felt or looked like you were just.
I'm sorry, am I supposed to be focused on anything other than Eric Smollett?
No. Today is about Eric Smollett. Today on Table
this
for Two.
This episode brought to you by Eric's
Matt and
Eric's
I will be
Kentucky
talking
Waterfall.
Eric's Kentucky
Waterfall. Business in front, but it's a party in back, y'all.
So tell me about your you went to Carnegie Mellon, which is
I did.
Really interesting because
yeah.
you also went with a bevy of actors that mm-hmm. have all
yeah.
had, that were your friends that had success or are having successful careers.
Yeah.
What was Carnegie Mellon like for you? And in regard to like, what did you really lean into? Like, the theater, the plays, like what were you?
I was so excited to be there and just have, it was a total reset for me in so many ways. And I didn't have, I'd already worked professionally as an actor on stage.
You
had.
When?
Yeah.
Where? Who?
Well, my very first job, which I don't even know if I've ever talked about it in press, is I was a background artist in a Chuck Norris movie that shot in Houston when I was 13 or 12.
No.
12 or 13, I swear to God. You didn't have that in your bingo card, did you?
No, yeah.
It was in downtown Houston. There was this period where I was doing forensics in middle school and doing these tournaments and things and doing well at those. And so my friend's mom and some
what
of our friends' parents.
What's forensics?
Forensics is like I would do like a 10-minute humorous piece or a 10-minute dramatic piece or
like
duet acting piece. Or,
right.
Yeah, no, we're doing forensic files.
Yeah, I thought you
were
doing
we're
like
studying
autopsies.
Cadavers.
Right.
and being judged on how well we assessed what had transpired. It's a weird
right, okay.
shared name, isn't
right.
it?
Yeah,
shared
it
title.
Really is.
Anyway, so we had my parents could care less. I remember asking them for headshots and they basically like laughed at me. I'm like, what are you talking about? Get out of here. Go play outside, which I'm glad they did.
Yeah.
But I had some friends' parents who like let me tag along when they're kids. So I went and I accompanied my friend to the Mickey Mouse Club audition. I just went with her and I was like, I'll try this too.
Right.
And I was such a jerk. I sang the same song. I was not prepared at all because
right.
I didn't even know what was going on.
Yeah.
My friend was like ready to go. And I sang the same song the person in front of me sang because I didn't know what else to sing. And I ended
what
up,
song was it?
It was Eternal Flame by the Bengals.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. I think I was 12.
Okay.
11 maybe. Uh-huh. And I ended up getting really close. And I remember the casting director from Mickey Mouse. This is the same year that like Gosling and
Timberlake,
Britney, Christina,
right.
all those people
wow.
were cast. And I remember him calling my house and saying, you know, we're thinking about bringing you out here to test for this, but you have to come to Florida. Like, would your parents come with you? And we were sitting at a dinner table and I was like, hey, mom, would you come with me? And they're like, I don't know. Like, what are you talking? Come
right.
back and eat dinner. And I
right.
think the cast director was like, yeah, all right, peace out, man. Not to say that I would have gotten it anyway, because I was nowhere
right.
prepared for that opportunity. But
well, it sounds like, you know, they saw something in you clearly.
Something, but so another one of the gigs that we did is we went, there was this movie called Sidekicks with Chuck Norris and the late Jonathan Brandis, may he rest in peace, who they were filming in Houston. And mm-hmm. You could go and be a background artist at this big karate tournament that was kind of the finale of the movie.
I'm gonna
so we did
this.
That for a day and I got to meet Chuck Norris and yeah, that was my first gig. But then I did a play when I was, right when I turned 18 on stage my senior year at the Alley Theater in Houston. We
okay.
did Streetcar Named Desire.
Okay.
I had some stage experience, but I had no formal training.
Right.
This is a really long answer to your original question.
No, I'm fascinated.
So I was excited to just have some sense of a technique or some way of approaching the work that wasn't just intuitive or just happy-go-lucky,
yeah.
you know? And so I was really excited to dig in. And it was a different program at the time. It was every class is obviously very different. There were some hyper-competitive classes. Ours was a pretty loving class, I have to say. We're all still really good friends. I have a text thread with all my classmates. But there was a cut program back then. And I think we started with 20 people in my class and ended with 9.
Wow.
So you'd come back after the holiday and be like, oh,
after the holiday, like after Christmas.
X, Y, and Z is not back. Did you hear? And you'd have to have these meetings with the faculty. This has all been taken away now, by the way, because it was, you know, sort of branded, you know, as a little too cruel for school.
Yeah.
And you'd meet with the faculty and you'd have to sit in front of them and be, and every single one of them would talk about how you did in voice and speech, how you did in singing, how you did in movement, how you did in acting, and sort of assess you in front of like a jury, basically.
So that like makes me think of an eat. You have to eat. Matt needs nourishment.
Is it okay that I'm just chewing into the microphone?
This is table two with lunch. Some people are like, guys, you know.
What's it called? What's it called when you do the chew and people like the sound of it? What's it called?
Oh, you're here and they're like, chew.
ASMR?
Like,
we're
going to
have an ASMR. This is a very special ASMR episode.
I do that sometimes with
brought to you by Kentucky Waterfalls.
How many times are we going to be able to say Kentucky Waterfalls? You bring up something that is I hear, which is like kind of horrible that this was, but kind of setting people up for the nature of your business of just rejection.
Yeah.
I mean, that is really and brutal. Like, would it be basically September through December, you did a play, you did this, that, and then you just weren't good enough? And
no, so it wasn't really that. It was rejection. More about what was your work ethic like?
Okay.
Because you weren't allowed to be a part of Greek life. It was your sole focus was to be a part of this conservatory.
Right.
And so we were in class, and when you're a freshman and sophomore, you're building the sets, you're building the costumes, you're running the lights, you're doing all the crew work for the junior and senior shows, which I think is a great thing.
Me too.
I mean, that really
was
a great entree into the creative process and ensemble aspect. But yeah, it's more about, okay, can you handle 40, 50 hours of class a week and also all the rehearsals on top of that and then doing crew at night and going from one class and doing a Shakespeare monologue and going to another class and doing a restoration piece and then going to another class and doing contemporary.
Oh, great.
Do you have the work ethic? Do you have the – can you take direction? Do you work well with other people? It was more sometimes about those things. And by the way, a lot of the people who got cut have gone on to have great careers. So I don't know that it was, you know – oftentimes it was a very subjective analysis from a very specific faculty.
Right.
But
what's so cool about it is it's such a moment in your life that you will never have again. And to be able to do all of that, and you don't even know really while you're in it, like this is so special. Because once you get out of it and you're in the real world and you're hustling and you have two jobs and you live in a one-bedroom apartment, it's like that's done.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's
you got permission to fall on your face.
Yeah.
And learn how to fail.
Right.
And find a rehearsal process where it was okay to fail.
Right.
And to figure out how to connect to something emotionally for the first time. And you're doing it in front of a group of 20 people.
Right.
It's like
the bond.
And so if you can do that, when all of a sudden you're on set and someone's like, hey, we don't have time to rehearse this. I know it's a big emotional scene.
Yeah.
We're probably only going to get one take before that we lose the sunset.
Yeah.
So I'm so sorry about this. Let's just go for it. Everybody roll camera. Like, it just makes it a little bit, it's not the same thing, but it's warmed you up to that kind of preparation.
Yeah. That's a big deal.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for pulling up a chair today on Table for Two. Before the break, Matt was telling us about his time at Carnegie Mellon. However, unlike most actors who moved to LA right away, Matt started out his career in New York. And I'm curious about those early days pounding the pavement in Manhattan.
So you leave school.
Mm-hmm.
You come to New York. You know, you've said... just, you know, your training on the soaps, and everyone who's ever been on a soap says the training is just, you can't beat it. It's mm-hmm. like you just really get used to learning lines fast, shifting, changing, you know, kind of sets you up a foundation. Your New York years versus the LA years, because what brought you to LA?
Oh, gosh. Well, going back a little bit, before I came to New York, I did, right out as I was kind of finishing school, I got Sundance Theater Lab, which is kind of, you know, the film lab where they work with new directors like Quentin Tarantino. A lot of big directors have come out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they give them the chance to workshop their new material with actors.
In Sundance?
At Sundance.
At Sundance.
And they do the same with theater.
Right.
Yeah. So, yes, exactly.
Right.
And so here I was, I was working with Craig Lucas and Moises Kaufman and all these, and I was doing the very first workshop of Spring Awakening with Duncan Sheik, where it was so raw that he was like still figuring out what chord it was on the guitar. And I was meeting all these idols who had just done their work when I was in school. Mm-hmm. Craig Lucas, I'd done a scene of his to get an agent.
Wow.
And so it was a really
audition for that, to get that?
The casting director came to our school and I did a monologue and I sang for her. And she said,
Matt's got a great voice.
I used to be a singer. I wouldn't call myself a singer anymore, not a real singer, but, okay, but not still. In 8 shows a week. Like, that would take me about a year to get back there. But
you do it.
But she brought me in when I was in New York and I auditioned. And then from that, I also got an audition for a musical called Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Sure. Hello.
And then I got, it had the same director, both projects. And so I got a job offer for that project as well. And so that brought me to New York. That ended up, 9/11 happened, so we lost the Broadway house. I've told this story a lot.
Oh,
so
my
I
God. I don't
so
know. I had to, you I had would to have been wait. On Broadway?
Yeah, I would have been on Broadway that? First. I was a cover. I wasn't the lead. I was okay. a cover, but I was also still. Like just out of school.
Right.
And it would have been such a different path.
Yeah.
But so I was while I was waiting on that house, like we were there waiting for the right house to open up.
Uh-huh.
9/11 happened. I lost my day job. And I ended up getting an audition for a soap, which is not like a future I'd really envisioned for myself coming out of theater school.
Right. Yes.
But I was whatever, let's go. And
yeah.
It was the best thing that ever could have happened to me. It was such a great training.
2 years, a year?
I was like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And I was terrified to be on camera.
Mm.
I would do anything on stage at that point. I was like,
really?
You know, primed for anything after conservatory. But I hadn't done, I'd never really been on camera.
See, I think, you know, one of the biggest mistakes people make, especially when they're young and they're leading person material,
mm-hmm.
they, you know, shoot out to LA to try to be like on like the 90210, let's say, I'm referring to my generation at that time, you
mm-hmm.
know, as opposed to building the foundation of really the acting skill.
Yeah.
Because you'll get there. If you got it. So like mm-hmm, you doing mm-hmm. that in Carnegie Mellon and then coming to New York and then everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
To then find yeah. yourself. So leaving the theater world, forcing yourself to get a gig on the TV world.
Yeah.
That teaches you the camera tech.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
camera acting, which is very different. How, because like what's different, if you can explain the difference nuances between theater acting, TV acting and movie acting. Because you kind of, you know, you're like, hit them all, baby. Because like the movie camera, I mean, the screen is so big. I'm not going to let Matt mm-hmm. say something here. Because, you know, if you haven't seen Maestro, how you act with your eyes and your smile, you're very good in this movie. And
thank
there's
you.
A moment where Leonard Bernstein comes up to you with the woman that he's with.
Felicia.
And you, unprepared, mm-hmm. have to be gracious
mm-hmm.
and welcoming and kind. And everything that is being read from your face mm-hmm. is pain and love. And it was a beautiful thing to do. So
thank
that to
you.
Me is like incredible movie.
Thank
actors.
You so much.
Anyway,
thank
now
you.
You can answer my question.
That's very kind of you to say. I think we were all very fortunate to be in Bradley's hands. I think he brings out the best in everybody and sees what you want to bring and tries to mm-hmm. bring that out in you. You know, I used to think there was this massive discrepancy between the two. I really did.
You did.
And the more and more I work in it, the less I feel that discrepancy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, there are different aspects of your, such an actory thing to say, but your instrument that you have to use
right.
when you're on stage, because the people, if it's a, you know,
yeah.
a 1,500 seat house, the people in the back row have to hear you, and
right.
depending on how you're mic'd,
right.
you have to take all that into consideration. And but in terms of connecting with the other actors and being present with them and trying to find something that's true to what you've rehearsed, but also that's alive in that moment. It's
right.
It's not terribly different than what's being on film.
Okay, I didn't realize that.
In
okay.
some regards,
mm-hmm.
I always think there are some amazing things that can happen on stage that I don't think can happen in any other medium, because it's almost like it's the closest to that kind of collective tribal experience that theater came out of like the guy around the fire in the cave talking about how the hunt went that day.
Yeah.
You have that one audience
yes.
for that one period of time, and it will never be exactly the same again.
Right. Right.
So there's something that's so unique about every different show that is,
mm-hmm.
is just incredible to me.
Yeah, because also I would imagine – because anything can happen within those 2 hours that might, whether it's a mistake, a drop line, a nuance of something, a delivered line that you're going to respond.
And different actors work differently too. Some people really like to do the same thing every night.
Right.
So you have to learn how to do that, work with that as well. And, obviously you don't want to go start doing cartwheels when you haven't rehearsed that, because then everything could go disastrously wrong. Okay.
Now he's doing cartwheels.
Yeah.
So, I asked, Sarah Jessica Parker on the show last season, at what point, when she was getting ready to shoot for Sex and the City and Just Like That, was there something that she did that all of a sudden Carrie Bradshaw was there? Because I had read earlier with Marilyn Monroe when she was walking down the stairs with Susan Strasberg and there were all these press, and she turns to Susan and says, "Are you ready? Do you want to see her?" And as she walks down the stairs, it's like she shifts her whole thing and she greets it.
Didn't they do that in My Week with Marilyn?
I think that they did.
Yeah.
So, and Sarah Jessica said, you get ready. Some days it could be 22 degrees out. You're outside. You take your down jacket off. You have the poofy skirt on.
She goes, straps on those Manolos.
Strap on those Manolos. Or now the Sarah Jessica collectibles. Yes. And collections.
Okay.
And she said, when the word action. Action, Carrie came alive. Because she was like, because I didn't know. I couldn't tell you who Carrie was going to be at that moment. If Carrie was going to be happy, sad. Like, I didn't know. And I thought that was also interesting.
That's a really exciting way to work.
Right, to your craft. So, you guys did, you did the revival of Boys in the Band. Billy Friedkin, who we love, who directed the movie, may he rest in peace. Joe Mantello. I remember going to the rehearsal and watching you guys do it, and I was so nervous watching you guys, like, here in L.A.
Yeah.
It was when we were really
on the stage, right?
Yes, yeah. I was just, like, freaked
at the
out.
Amundsen.
Yes, Joe was like, what is wrong with you? I'm like, freaked out.
It is intense. I was freaked out too.
So you do this show and you're amazing in it and the cast is amazing in it. And I just feel like, wow. And Joe is such a great director. And then you also then bring it to the screen.
Yeah. With
the same cast.
And the same director, right. Which is kind of unheard of.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Was there a difference in the character, or the development, or in the process of, because now it's not that hour and a half show that's live that all of a sudden, somebody does, you're like doing the take.
Yeah. I think the real challenge in that regard was giving yourself permission in a new medium to not just rely on what you knew worked on stage, not just to rely on what you knew would get a laugh on stage
because
you've done it 150 times or whatever it was, I think it was less than that, but to keep exploring and keep finding new things. And then Joe could get in and fine tune certain moments. There's one moment in particular, because the play ends with this sort of me holding Jim Parsons' character in this Pieta, and he's had this whole meltdown and my character's trying to comfort him. And on stage, it could be any number of ways. Wherever we were that night is just wherever we were that night.
Right.
Sometimes wherever we were that night, depending on what had just happened the hour and a half before and how vicious it got or how crazy it got.
Which must mean also like how you enter the room that day. Like, what was your day like? What was the audience's day like?
Yeah.
What's all the energy that's brought into the room collectively that you then go out and do this thing? It's going to be different.
I feel like that's one thing I've learned more and more about the work. Not that this is so, no one wants to hear this, but rather than trying to drown things out and make it what you want it to be, to bring everything into what's happening right then and there,
This.
Bring your day to the work.
If we're doing
a scene, rather than, making X person feel or look like I want to, use what he's actually doing, what's going on in his eye, what happened to his hair that day or whatever. Like, really use that.
Right.
Which makes it
interesting and
it
also
makes it
more
alive
interesting for
in
you.
A way
that
something, I remember I was watching a rough cut of Maestro with Bradley, and This might have been the biggest lesson I learned from him on this film. I can't believe I'm giving it away for free on your podcast.
Oh my God. Well, it's me.
But it's just us.
It's just us.
And he said to me, in the scene, he tripped as he was going up the stairs. I don't even know if the scene's in the movie anymore. And I said, and something about him doing that, it was an early scene in the movie at the time. And it just, as an audience member, I relaxed because it took a sense of preciousness out of it, because right. something real and human and in the moment and alive right. happened in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, were there takes where you didn't trip? And do you care that you tripped or whatever? And he was like, oh no, I'm hoping that I trip.
Right.
Because then something's going to happen that's real.
Right. Right.
And I think, you know, it doesn't happen every take. It doesn't happen every scene. But
no.
you're always hoping for that. If you've been doing it for a while, that's yeah. kind of the moment you're hoping for. And even on stage, that can be what is the most electric thing.
Completely.
Have you seen like Mary Louise Parker do a play?
Yeah.
And you get that sense that like
right.
it's and never the same
right,
twice.
Right, never. Even in her, like, right. It's just
yeah.
whatever is going on in her
it's
mind.
Electric it's electric to watch.
Yeah.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher. I'm so excited to tell you about the brand new series of The Girlfriends. In season one, we told you about the murder of Gail Katz at the hands of my ex-boyfriend, Bob. At one point, a woman's torso washed up on Staten Island and was misidentified as Gail. She spent 9 years in Gail's grave, and then she just disappeared.
It's almost like it's become this moral obligation to find her.
And that's what we're going to do. Find this missing girlfriend and tell her story. With the help of some of your favorite girlfriends from season one, like my producer, Anna.
Oh my God.
My friend, Dr. Mindy Shapiro.
Hi, it's Dr. Shapiro, and I'd like to speak with the deputy medical examiner.
And of course, Gail's sister, Elaine Katz.
Having no closure, it kills you.
Join us as we try to solve a 35-year-old cold case. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be one hell of a ride.
What?
I can't believe this.
Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A new season of Bridgerton is here. And with it, a new season of Bridgerton, the official podcast. I'm your host, Gabrielle Collins, and this season, we are bringing fans even deeper into the ton. Colin Bridgerton has returned from his travels abroad. Is betrothal written in the stars for the eligible bachelor? Meanwhile, the ton is reverberating with speculation of who holds Lady Whistledown's pen. We're discussing it all. I sit down with Nicola Coughlan, Luke Newton, Shonda Rhimes, and more to offer an exclusive peek behind the scenes of each episode of the new season. Watch season three of the Shondaland series on Netflix. Then, fall in love all over again by listening to Bridgerton, the official podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to catch a new episode every Thursday.
Acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Rosie, somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned. It feels so good.
It does. And like always, we'll be here every week covering the wide world of TV, movies, comics, and geek culture.
That's right. We'll be talking about Batman, heroes of that stature, and of course, we'll be inviting our friends in the industry to come geek out with us and share stories. We'll hear from TV writers, from actors, comics creators, pop culture critics, and more.
Nothing is off the table, because geek culture is pop culture, and we can't wait to share our love of it all with you every single week.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Table for Two. Matt's big screen debut was in 2005's Flight Plan with Jodie Foster. As someone who has always loved and been in awe of Jodie Foster, I'm curious what it was like to work with such an iconic actor.
You know, I am obsessed for years with Jodie Foster.
Mm.
I mean, I just am. And, you know, same. She is of my generation, mm-hmm. and I just, mm-hmm. and she, Naiad, I was like, wow. This
How is good incredible. Are the two of them in Naiad?
They're incredible. They're incredible.
I told them both. I want to see them take it on the road.
Yeah.
I want to see those two characters in everything.
Everything.
It's Tell me so about nice working to see with this her. Beautiful lesbian friendship. Yes. Not even lesbian, just this beautiful
just right.
friendship between these women.
Right. It's just.
And they're both stunningly beautiful, but have not given themselves over to vanity in a way
no.
that it takes you out of the story
no,
you know?
At all. It's like they're so, yeah, and they're such
and
the
Jodie
real
is
deal.
One of the most beautiful humans to ever exist. I mean,
completely. You know, and it's interesting to me because. In the early 90s, sort of being in LA, there was just a little bit of a world. She's obviously a very private person.
Yeah.
And she, so I knew a couple people that were close in her circle, but did not know her, but would see her occasionally. And how much the world has changed
mm-hmm.
for being able to share, you know, her life. And you worked with her. And when you work with someone like that, how do you, at that point in your career and age, like walk onto a set and be like, hey, like, I'm about to.
Oh, I was dying. It was because it was the first film I ever did. It was my
that was
very
number
first
one?
Film. Yeah.
Holy cannoli.
And I didn't have a ton to do in it, but it all took place on an airplane.
Right.
So we all had to be there all the time. And you just never knew with this director when you were going to be in a shot,
right.
when it was going to feature you, when you were going to have a lot of line, you know, whenever it was, he would just call audibles.
Right.
Robert Schwenka, great director. And Jodie was so, it was like the nice boon of the job was that the director said you can sit in on all the rehearsals with Jodie Foster and Peter Sarsgaard and watch Sean Bean, watch how they work, watch
right.
what their process is like, and watch them on set.
Right.
And I was like, wait, I'm getting paid to have a masterclass?
Right.
Let's go.
Seriously.
And so,
right.
One of the things I learned the most about Jodie was just how to handle yourself on a set. I mean, she is a consummate professional.
Mm-hmm.
She knows the whole crew's name. She knows the whole cast name. And that was a big cast. It was a big movie. And she just was so gracious and kind. And Jodie is somebody that wherever my career was after that, if I saw her in public, she would treat me the same, like a human. And I think I look at someone like her, I look at someone like Jason Bateman, and I think one of the hardest things to do is to come up in this industry, Drew Barrymore, and to come out the other end of it a healthy, sane human being, because there are just so many trappings along the way.
Yeah.
And Jodie is the height of sanity in this industry,
right.
the height of humanity in
right.
this industry. So what she's achieved and what she has maintained for herself is so commendable.
Yeah. It's like we went to the Hollywood Bowl, and unbeknownst to me, we were in a box with Jodie and her wife several months ago. And it was, I almost couldn't talk because of the effect that her work had at the time when I was in my 20s. And, you know, I mean, I think maybe Jodie's like 2 to 3 years older than me. So we're really, I just thought like, wow, you.
She's great though at also kind of, she's like Julia Roberts. She's great at kind of taking away that veneer as well.
And completely.
And immediately having a human connection with you. And I think there's a real art to that. And I think it's an unfortunate responsibility of people who are huge stars who then have to do a scene with you to suddenly break it all down and go,
right.
hey, we're just in this scene together. And we're just two human beings having an interaction.
Yeah. You know, okay, so Mr. Woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things, is it responsibility? Do you feel it's a responsibility? I mean, that you now carry this torch of being sort of this, like, leading man at a time that it didn't exist publicly. You know, you've made choices, many different choices. You've played, you know, from all your, you know, your movies and TV, a lot of which you're not playing gay characters, you're playing. But, you know, we talked about Boys in the Band, we talked about Fellow Travelers, we didn't talk about The Normal Heart, but my God, what a heartbreaking
I remember running into you on the street in New York City, and you were like 6 pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. Do you feel there's like a responsibility that you carry? I mean, you got a beautiful award this year, last year by HRC that mm-hmm. the President of the United States gave you, which is was a big deal. Like you've really created a life for yourself where there's a responsibility to it. How does that feel? Do you feel that?
It's interesting. I worked with Diane, the lovely Diane Carroll. May she rest in peace. I miss her for 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so curious. I remember talking to her early on, and because she was the first African-American woman to have her own hour-long primetime show. Anyway, I asked her, I was like, what was that like? Did you feel it? And she said, I just thought of myself as an actor.
Right.
And who had a great role, and I was playing that. And that gave me such a sense of perspective on it all.
Okay.
Because she had a whole... a lifetime to look back on that moment, you know?
Right.
So I was fortunate to be with her in that moment and have that answer. But, you know, my biggest thing, if I'm able to be in a piece where it has LGBTQ themes or characters, and I'm fortunate enough to be, you know, whether it's just an actor or I'm producing, I just don't want to drop the ball.
Right.
That's the only responsibility I feel, because there is this sense of like...
Which you never will because you take it so...
You know, there are so many factors that go into something like that, but you just know that it's a rare opportunity just to even get to be at that table. Mm-hmm. So I want to make sure other people get to be there too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's not at the forefront of my mind, but I think that's somewhere in the back of my mind.
Right.
Outside of that, it's so funny that people ask me all these giant social questions and where I fit into the schemes of society. And they're all questions that I can't answer.
Right.
You know, they think that I have some grand answer that's going to be the definitive. And it's just not the way the world works. It's not the way the zeitgeist works. It's not the way our culture shapes and shifts.
I've had such a great time today at lunch with my friend Matt Bomer, and I just need to know what life is like for such a busy actor.
Maddie, you have, first of all, this is a true one of many, and you've had them happen before, but it's really been fascinating, amazing to watch as your friend this moment in time that your career has brought you. I think it's also interesting that there was that strike that made everything wait. So everything
it was like getting pulled back on a slingshot.
I bet.
Because the one thing I was bummed about, and it's all panned out fine, but I really wanted to go to the Venice Film Festival because you just don't get to do that every day.
Right.
And to get to show up with
deal.
Bradley and Carrie and Steven Spielberg would have just been so cool. Assuming they would have even invited me, who knows?
Well, they would have.
But if they had, but other than that, I had really kind of made this weird piece that the work was just out in the world and it was going to be what it was. And hopefully folks would find the show and the social media people from the studios and networks would do their job and create awareness however they do. And then all of a sudden we were unleashed.
No, you were unleashed. So, I mean,
it was like literally the strike ended.
Yes.
There was a phone call in the next hour. I was on a plane the next day.
Yeah.
And I have not stopped since.
You have not stopped.
It's been pretty wild.
So I just need to acknowledge as we, I believe, come to an end to our lunch, and we have a big weekend ahead of us.
We do.
To say the fact that you, the generosity of Matt Bomer, if you've pulled up a chair today, the fact that he's sitting with me in a week where we are celebrating a milestone birthday for his husband, in a week where you just had the Golden Globe weekend, which is press, 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 in a week where you're does not go unnoticed, unappreciated, and really means the world to me that you would take the time to sit and have just a sort of quiet little lunch in a nook corner of LA.
Bruce, we could be in the middle of that Julia Roberts movie and I would make the time for you. That's how deep my love for you and Brian and your family goes.
Thank you. I love you, Matt Bomer.
Anytime. I love you too, buddy.
And thank you everyone for listening. And
thank you.
Talk
Thanks
later.
For having me.
You got it.
Table for Two with Bruce Bozzi is produced by iHeartRadio, 737 Park, and Airmail. Our executive producers are Bruce Bozzi, Nathan King. Our supervising producer and editor is Dylan Fagan. Table for Two is researched and written by Jack Sullivan. Our sound engineers are Emil B. Klein, Jess Cranage, Evan Taylor, and Jesse Funk. Our music supervisor is Randall Poster. Our talent booking is done by Jane Sarkin. Table for Two's social media manager is Gracie Wiener. Special thanks to Amy Sugarman, Uni Scherer, Kevin Uvain, Bobby Bauer, Allison Cantor-Graber, Barbara Jen, Jeff Klein, and the staff at the Tower Bar in the world-famous Sunset Tower Hotel in Hollywood. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey, girlfriends, it's me, Carol Fisher, back with another season of the global number one podcast, The Girlfriends. Last time, we investigated the murder of Gail Katz. This time, we're uncovering the identity of the woman who was buried in Gail's grave for a decade before she disappeared. Join me and the rest of the club as we tell her story. Listen to season two of The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.